on Ways and Means. Today, colleagues, we will be continuing Senate Bill 5520, Department of Justice Budget, and we are very appreciative that we have Ms. Williams and Mr. Castor here to present. The first portion is one that is a significant increase to the Department of Justice budget and a very important one that we understand. So please try to stay focused and work on this. Ms. Williams, please come forward and give your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee.
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I just passed out a page, which is a replacement page for the last page under the Defense of Criminal Convictions, the last page under that tab. So instead, it should say number 11, not number 1. But this is something the agency brought to replace that page.
Which tab is it again?
Under Defense of Criminal Convictions, which is actually the tab that Ms. Williams is going to talk about.
And it's really number 11.
Right.
And does not supplant another page.
It actually, if you rip the last page out and put this one in.
And this is the page that you've written out. That doesn't seem right.
You're in the wrong notebook.
No,
you're in the big book.
Do I have
So we're ripping out mandated case law, right?
So you're ripping out a page that looks like.
Oh, this is the most fun we've had in the legislature.
Oh, frustrations of the
Okay, are we ready to go? Ms. Williams.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. This is obviously is a very important package for the Department of Justice. What I'm going to do is to first of all explain there are five different types of cases that we defend in the Defense of Criminal Convictions program, and I'm going to first describe what those five types of cases are, and then I'm going to describe the model that we use to project our caseload needs, and that model is based on two components. First of all, the number of cases in each of those five types of cases, and then the cost per case. So I'll go through some material that will help you understand the number of cases, the cost per case. And then I've got a series of slides that I hope will show what has happened this biennium and what that means for our needs for next biennium. And all of that goes into what package 040 is going to fund. So starting on page one of the Defense of Criminal Convictions, the slide at the bottom, I'm going to walk through this and explain what the five kinds of cases are that are funded in this program. And I'm going to talk about a typical criminal case. There are some exceptions, and I'm going to just ignore those for the time being. So in most cases, you have a criminal conviction that the district attorney represents the state in those prosecutions. Once that conviction is obtained by the district attorney, then the Department of Justice steps in and handles representation of the state through the rest of the challenges to the conviction. The starting point for us is the direct appeal from the conviction. So that's the first type of case that we handle. In the direct appeal, the defendant is represented usually by the public defenders from Public Defense Services Corporation. They will review the record that was created in the trial court, the testimony, the exhibits. They will prepare a brief that identifies any claims of error that they identify from that record. And then that appellate process that I described yesterday, we will review the brief, review the record, respond to those claims of error, and the Court of Appeals will decide those issues. That direct appeal process in a typical case usually is only through the Court of Appeals, and it takes 3 to 4 years to complete. If Supreme Court review is allowed, you can tack on another additional 1 to 2 years for that process to work. Once that direct appeal process is complete, the defendant then moves to the state post-conviction process. And that starts over again in the state trial courts. And that's because we need a new record created. You cannot raise issues in post-conviction that you could have raised on direct appeal. And the two most common issues that we see in the post-conviction process are my trial attorney was inadequate and or my appellate attorney was inadequate. And so to address those issues, you need to create a new record, and that's created in the post-conviction trial court. From there, the decision of the post-conviction trial court can go back through the appellate process, again, usually in the Court of Appeals. And that entire post-conviction process, both the trial process and the appellate review, takes another 4 to 5 years. And you would tack on again another 1 to 2 if the Supreme Court allowed review. Once we get through that part of the process, then we're done with the state challenges to the conviction, and we move to the federal courts. And starting again in the federal trial court, and then the appeal from those decisions go to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And for purposes of this discussion, there are two things that are important to understand. In federal habeas, there are some limitations on the federal courts. The defendant has to, first of all, have presented these federal claims in the state court process, either on the direct appeal or through the post-conviction process, or the federal court shouldn't look at them. And if the state courts have made findings of fact, the federal courts have to defer to those findings. So there are limitations on what the federal courts can consider and how they should consider the claims. But even with those limitations, as you're going to see, the federal habeas cases are the most expensive cases for us to litigate. Okay, so turning now to page 2. The top slide just shows how those five categories of cases, how the work is divided between them. Most of the work is in the direct appeals. As you go through the system, it's less and less of our time is spent on the cases. So the federal habeas cases are a small percentage of our total workload compared to the direct appeals. So those are the five kinds of cases that we deal with. And I'm now going to turn to the numbers of cases in each of those five categories. And I'm going to start a little bit out of order by looking at the trial cases. The post-conviction trial cases are at the bottom of page 2, and that shows the number of cases that we've opened and the number of post-conviction trial cases pending for each fiscal year for the past several fiscal years. There's a slight blip in the number of cases opened in fiscal year 05. That's because the United States Supreme Court had a significant change in how we look at sentencing issues, and that resulted in a number of cases being filed in the post-conviction trial court on that issue. Fortunately, it was actually a fairly narrow legal issue, and the trial attorneys were able to respond very efficiently to those cases. So you'll notice that our number of pending cases didn't increase as a result, and in fact, they've been able to bring that backlog down slightly. Turning to the top of page 3, the federal habeas trial cases open and pending. Here we have seen growth in the number of new federal habeas trial cases, and the backlog of pending cases has also grown. And part of what's addressed in the package 040 are additional positions that would help us deal with this growth in the federal habeas trial area. Now, the rest of the discussion is going to shift to the three types of appellate cases. And the reason for that is that in dealing with the shortfall this biennium, we had some ability, as I'll describe, to make some adjustments in the appellate work that allowed us to get through the biennium. In the trial work, if we don't appear, we don't win. And so we basically had to fund the trial workload and then deal with the shortfall on the appellate side. So the rest of the discussion is going to focus heavily on what we've done in the appellate caseload. The slide at the bottom of page 3, gives you an overview of the number of cases in those three kinds of appeals over the last several fiscal years and then projected into next biennium. And there are two things that I'd like to have you pay special attention to in that slide. First of all, if you compare last biennium and this biennium, for all three categories, there was significant growth in the number of cases. So we've had growth, but there were no new additional resources to deal with that growth. And so when we get to kind of where are we now with the package 040, part of it is dealing with the increase in the number of cases from last biennium to this biennium that we didn't deal with in our budget for this biennium. The second thing I'd like to point out on this one is that in projecting the cases for next biennium and in building this model, we've taken a very conservative approach whenever we could, And that included assuming that the public defender's office would maintain their output and not increase it. And so the projections for fiscal year 08 and 09 look very similar to what we have seen in terms of our caseload numbers for this fiscal year. Okay. And if we can turn now to page 4, we carve out the capital cases and look at them separate from the non-capital cases. And that's because the capital cases are much more costly to handle in all of these categories of review. A capital case goes through the same stages of review. There are some differences that on the direct appeal, instead of it going to the Court of Appeals, it goes straight to the Oregon Supreme Court. But otherwise, it will proceed through the same five categories of review. The voters enacted the death penalty in, reenacted it in 1983, and it took effect in 1984. And it wasn't until 1992 that we actually had the first death penalty case make it through the direct appeal process and have both the conviction and the sentence upheld. So there are a number of years in there where the Supreme Court, in reviewing these cases, identified problems in the death penalty system, and that resulted in a number of reversals and remands for new trials or new sentencing proceedings. But since 1992, we've had then a number of cases go through the direct appeals, and what's happened is those cases have basically piled up in the post-conviction trial court. The defendants have not been eager to move the cases along in the post-conviction trial courts. The trial courts have been willing to let us have those cases sit, and we have not had the resources to move them along. As a result, we now have cases that are aging in the post-conviction trial court that, to be honest, we simply have to start moving those cases along. And we've begun doing that very slowly, and we've built this model to reflect the need to slowly begin moving those cases through the post-conviction trial court. We can't continue the delay that we've had up to this point. But the model that we've built really does move it very slowly. And, in fact, if we were to carry this model forward, it would take us 20 years to catch up so that all of the cases that are the new ones that are coming in plus the ones that have been sitting in the post-conviction trial court would all be caught up and things would be moving more like the non-capital cases. But we do have some increase in moving these cases out of the post-conviction trial court, and once that happens, they get back on a schedule that requires us to actually move them forward. And so what you see is for this biennium and then projected into next biennium, significant growth in the cost of the capital cases, but we're really talking about two or three cases moving forward into these new phases. At this point, we have four cases that have made it through the post-conviction appeals process and are just in the initial phases of the federal habeas trial process. Some of them have sort of backed up and tried to start over again the post-conviction process, and frankly, that's where they are. But they will be moving forward into federal habeas next biennium. So those are the numbers of cases.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Brown.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think what I'm struggling with is why we're seeing this huge number, and maybe you're going to get to this, of why we're seeing these huge numbers of appeals. I mean, if you look on page 3, your diagram shows the bottom appellate new cases by category. We're talking hundreds within a period of year, unless I'm reading the chart wrong, you know, fiscal year from 05 to 06, you know, maybe 200 to 300 more cases. What's driving the aggressive appellate system? And I assume a portion of it is that we funded the appellate side and on the defense side, but I'm assuming that, I don't know if it's the, you know, Measure 11 stuff or what's driving the increase in requesting appeals, I guess is what I would ask.
Chair Shields, Senator Brown, the drivers on this, as I said yesterday, we're 95% responsive on these cases.
Right, right.
So it's the cases coming in, and I think that it's no longer really Measure 11. That's been around long enough. For some reason, Oregon litigants appeal a greater percentage of their cases than we see in other states. And so when you look at a state-to-state comparison, we simply have more of our defendants who take advantage of the option of appealing. But then I think the main thing that's driving what we're seeing in terms of our workload is that the public defenders have increased their output.
Okay.
And now whether they've done it because of additional resources or because they've become more efficient or a combination of that, once they increase their output, right, that has this immediate impact on us, and that's really what we're seeing.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I have a follow-up, and I apologize. I don't mean this question to be offensive to to anyone in any way, but I'm trying to understand the connections or the relationships, why things go up and down and what the drivers are. If the output has increased, and if one of the reasons for appeal, for example, is the trial attorney or the appellate attorney was inadequate, is there a relationship between how much we're trying to accomplish without enough resources, and does that impact the quality?
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, that's an excellent question. And I'll touch on it a little bit, but I can tell you from our experience in the current biennium to deal with the workload issues, we have told our attorneys to cut their briefing to the bare bones, to do the minimal amount of work that they can do in these cases to just move them out the door, because we've had to do that. And in reviewing those briefs, I can tell you that the consequence of that is sometimes we're missing things, and we're not doing the kind of work that I would expect us to do if I were just simply looking at what's necessary for our representation of the state. And I imagine that the same thing happens on the other side of the case. The more you push to get things done quickly, the more likely you are to see attorneys missing issues, not really presenting all that should be presented in a case. And because of these layers of review, if that happens on the direct appeal, that has consequences both for the kinds of claims that can be raised in post-conviction and in federal habeas. And so the more you may miss some steps, it may simply add to the cost further down the road in these cases.
Can I have just a brief comment?
Follow up, yes.
Then it seems like sometimes it's ill-advised. What may seem efficient or a thrifty way to do something could end up costing more in the long run, if we're not careful about where we're investing our resources. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Okay, so we've now gone through the number of cases in each of the five types of cases. On page four, the bottom of the page shows the cost per case for each of those types of cases. I have them presented for the non-capital cases, which is the bulk of our workload, and then for the capital cases, so that you can see that the cost for the capital cases is significantly higher than for the non-capital cases. And so even though the numbers are very, very small, the slightest change in those numbers can have a very large fiscal impact on in terms of our resource needs. The other thing I would point out on this table is that for the capital cases in federal habeas trial and on appeal, since we have cases just beginning to enter that part of the system, we've had to make a guess about what those costs are going to be. And what we did was to take the cost for the non-capital cases and multiply it by 15. On the direct appeals, if you do the math, that's actually the capital cases are 20 times as expensive as the non-capital cases. I think the 15 factor is low. But we needed to start somewhere in terms of building this model. And what we saw when we had the first direct appeals in this area is that they were very expensive to handle because the courts were looking at everything about the death penalty system in Oregon. And I expect the same thing is going to happen as the federal courts get their first look at Oregon's death penalty system. These cases are going to be very costly to litigate as we move the first cases through the federal habeas process. Turning now to the top of page five, this shows what we have been able to do to bring down the cost per case. And if you look in each of these three categories from, and these are actually calendar years, so from 2003 to 2006, these are just non-capital cases, we've significantly reduced the average cost per case. And in building this model, we had to decide what figure we were going to use then to project costs for next biennium. We did not take the figure from 2006 because I think that's not sustainable. And part of it, Representative Nathanson, goes to your question in terms of missing things. I think we can't keep going at the rate we're going without jeopardizing some of the quality of the work that we need to do. And it's also simply that as we hire new attorneys to do this work, we can't expect them to produce at the same rate as our attorneys who have been doing this for 5 to 20 years. And so instead of taking the last year of data, what we did was to take the first fiscal year of this biennium. So our costs per case that we've built into the model are somewhere between the 2005 and 2006 costs that we saw, and the model is based on those figures that are in the table at the bottom of page 4. The bottom of page 5 lists some of the factors that drive the increase in the caseload, and I'm not going to talk about those. I will talk about them as we go through some of these other slides. And also, if we can turn to page 6 and ignore it for the moment, and I'll come back to it after I sort of explain how we got to delay and why that matters in these cases. The slides on page 7 are the same slides that were in the appellate presentation describing things that we've done to be more efficient. And I just wanted to point out two things that are important to note for the defense of criminal convictions. The first one is in talking about waiver of appearance. Waiver of appearance is not a good thing for criminal cases. The only time that we want to waive appearance in a criminal case is when the defense attorney files something that's called a Balfour brief. And a Balfour brief means that the attorney has reviewed the record and finds no error in the case. And so they'll file a brief that basically says that. There's no error that we've identified in the case. If they do that, we don't even count it as an incoming case, and we'll waive appearance. But other than that, if there is an issue presented, we don't want to waive appearance because the state's position is not represented in the case, and it shifts the costs of the work that we do to the appellate court. And so it's not a savings because that work still has to be done. It just means instead of us doing it and advocating for the state, it puts that responsibility on the appellate court. So our goal in getting through this biennium and projecting the needs for next biennium is to avoid waiving appearance in these criminal cases. The second thing I want to point out on this is the designation of lead cases for issues that repeat. We've worked very closely with Chief Judge Brewer and with Pete Gartland from the Public Defender's Office to find ways to make this work more efficiently, and that includes finding issues that repeat in case after case. The sentencing issue that the U.S. Supreme Court created for us is a good example. There were a number of legal questions about how that opinion was going to apply to our state cases. We identified those legal issues. We picked a single case to have full briefing on, and then we had a number of other cases that just tagged along behind with it. So when you see references to limited briefing, where we were able to brief cases in less than an hour, that's because we had this process of having a lead case and then limited briefing in the cases. And we do that same sort of coordinating effort with the Supreme Court, and now we've been doing it with the federal courts as the capital cases move into federal habeas. For the last year, I've been meeting with federal trial judges and their staff and the federal public defenders to talk about the procedures that we're going to follow in those federal habeas cases. And so the key to it is that even though we've got three players with very distinct roles in the system, we share the goal of having the system work as efficiently and effectively as we can, and we'll continue to look for ways to make that happen because I think that's one of our best places for generating some additional savings in this area. Okay, now starting on page 8, I've got 6 slides that I hope will explain what we've done this biennium, what that means for next biennium, and why the large dollars are attached to package 040. Slide number 1 at the top of page 8 just sets out what the demand was for the appellate work for this biennium. So if you assign out all of the cases that we had to assign out, and you look at the cost per case, and much of this is actually based on actual cost, not the projected cost, We needed about 110,000 attorney hours to handle those cases. That was the demand for the current biennium. If you look at slide 2, that breaks that demand into two pieces, the amount that was funded for this biennium and the amount that was not funded. And it, about 44,000 hours were not funded for the budget for this biennium. So what did we do? If you turn to slide 3 at the top of page 9, what we did was to take a large stack of cases and basically hang on to them and not work them, and we said, we'll do them next biennium. And so to understand that, you need to understand one of the pieces of the appellate process that I didn't explain yesterday, and that's the ability to delay cases. When we first are assigned a case, and the court gives us 49 days to prepare the brief in the case, but the court also permits you to ask for additional time beyond that 49 days. And when we realized the situation that we were going to face with this budget, we talked to the chief judge about what's the maximum that we can delay these cases. How long can we hang on to them before we have to brief them? And he agreed that we could delay the cases for a total of about a year, meaning that for many of the cases, they really do simply sit in our office, and what we're doing is holding on to them until next biennium, and then we'll brief them. By doing that, we were able to move about 35,000 hours of work from this biennium to next biennium. So it's work that still has to be done, but we didn't have to do it this biennium. That still left about 350 cases that would have to be done this biennium, but we didn't have funding for. And so we went to the emergency board and said, we need additional funding or we have to waive appearance in 350 criminal cases. The emergency board gave us that additional funding, and we had our attorneys really do this bare bones briefing and do the absolute minimum that they needed to do on these cases. And we were able to deal with the caseload for this biennium. But now when you drop down to slide 4, it shows what impact that has on the budget for next biennium. That delay was a one-time strategy that we can't continue to repeat. Even though we can move that number of hours forward again, we can't use that strategy to reduce the work that we have to do. So when you build the model for 07-09, the demand is made up of the cases that we've delayed from this biennium into next biennium, plus all of the new cases. We're still able to delay some cases, but only about the same number of hours that we were able to delay this biennium into next biennium. So if on this chart you compare the dark portions of the two columns, the difference is what we absolutely have to work this biennium to avoid waiving appearance and what we'll have to work next biennium to avoid waiving appearance. And the package 040 funds that difference. And I'd note the little tiny type at the bottom is that includes the $2 million emergency board special purpose appropriation. So we're assuming that we'll be using at least some of that, and I'll talk about how much of that. And if we move on then to page 10, slide number 5, that simply shows what happens then in the next biennium. So that we can continue to have those unfunded hours and that delay moving forward as we look at the need down the road, but it doesn't allow us to basically, we can't bring the workload for next biennium down to what we were able to bring it down for this biennium. So that delay worked once, and we don't have a similar strategy for next biennium. The last chart, chart number 6, we've blown it up here so that you can see it a little better. This is kind of the good news, bad news chart of all of this. The good news is that we are always looking to see if we can improve how we model and how we're able to predict the need. We actually made some changes in terms of the way we project the amount of cases that we can delay and found that we can do a better projection, and that would result in a savings or money that we wouldn't need to spend in 07-09 but would spend in 09-11 of about $500,000. So we could delay an additional $500,000 worth of work from next biennium into the 09-11 biennium. That's the good news. The bad news is we also updated our forecast. We added some additional months of actual data instead of projected data, and that's the really skinny line that you see. It increases our projected cost for next biennium by $170,000. But with the $500,000 savings from delaying more cases, that would be okay. But then we have more bad news. The next column is an additional cost for 07-09. Sorry, not the next column, but the next block in that middle column. The chief judge has said that we need to reduce the delay and bring it down from a total of a year to 300 days by the end of this year. And what that means is there are 2 months' worth of cases that we built this model assuming we could delay from next biennium into 09-11 that we're going to have to brief next biennium. And that's an additional cost of $1 million. And let me just say quickly that the chief judge isn't being mean to us, and he's actually been very helpful in helping us get through the resource problems that we face this biennium. The reason for reducing that delay is there are two reasons, really. One is a policy issue that is for, I think, the chief and for the legislature to consider, and that's how long is too long for these cases to take in the system. We win about 93% of our criminal cases, but when you add up the different kinds of challenges, it means that about 10% of these defendants have a legitimate issue that requires some change in their sentence or the convictions. And yet, if that issue is not addressed until they get to federal habeas, it may be 10 or more years from the time of the conviction before they're having that issue addressed. So as a policy question, there's a point at which the delay is simply too great. And that's part of the chief judge's reasoning for bringing this down. But there's also cost implication for this. If the reversal of a conviction or a sentence comes 10 years after the conviction and the case goes back to the district attorney to re-prosecute the case, it's much harder to re-prosecute a case 10 years after you've prosecuted than if you're able to do it 2 or 3 years after you've done the initial prosecution, because you may not have witnesses, you may not have the evidence still. And so there's an added cost that comes about from the delay. The other added cost is because of that limitation I told you about on the federal habeas cases. If the state process takes too long, the federal courts can say the state process is inadequate, and so those limitations on what we get to look at go out the door. The federal courts are able to look at federal issues that were not raised first in the state courts, and they're able to look at those issues afresh without deferring to the findings of that the state courts have made. And so right now the federal cases are our most costly cases. If we don't have those limitations on the federal courts, those cases are going to be even more expensive to litigate. And we've seen that happen because there are some exceptions where that does happen already. We have some experience with it, and we've seen that other states have experience with it, so we know how those costs can increase. So reducing delay has both a policy impact and a fiscal impact, and that is all part of the reason for trying to bring down the delay in these cases. The last addition in that center column, then, is we built the model assuming that the public defender's output would remain pretty constant. We have met with Ingrid Swenson from the public defender's office and with their legislative fiscal analyst. We know that they have a backlog of cases and that they're going to be asking for additional resources to address that backlog of cases. They've told us that they're going to ask for an additional 8 attorneys to work on direct appeals. So we looked at what impact that would have in terms of the work that we would have to do next biennium. And assuming that they had 8 additional attorneys working on direct appeals, that's a 1/3 increase from what they have right now. We tried to make some adjustments because there's going to be a learning curve for those new attorneys like there would be for ours, and they may not all start July 1. So what we did was to assume a start date for the 8 attorneys of October 1, and this is all guessing because we don't know what will happen in terms of their budgeting process or the hiring process. But assuming that they had 8 new attorneys starting October 1, and we still delayed as many of those new cases that they could produce, we would still have an increase in the work that we had to do for 07-09 of $1.9 million. And so all of those changes would, they net out to an additional $2.5 million beyond what is in the proposed budget. Just a couple of one other thing that I wanted to mention on the reducing the delay piece. That's a one-time cost. That's the $1 million to bring down the delay. It does not continue as you project the cost in the future biennia, and it actually brings down the cost for the 09-11 biennium because it's work that we'll be doing this biennium that otherwise would have been waiting for us in 09-11. So. Although it would be a cost for 07-09, it has the same sort of decrease of cost for 09-11. The last page then just sort of captures the budget history over the last several biennia, and then the bottom slide on the new page that's been inserted summarizes what the package 040 actually funds in terms of the numbers of positions for both the appellate division and the trial division. And some of those would come from the emergency board special appropriation. That last position that's an office specialist for trial, we still need to figure out how to add that in. The slides that I skipped are back on page 6, and just very briefly, what those show is how the delay in cases has progressed from 2003 to 2006, that we're delaying more and more cases longer and longer for direct appeals and post-conviction appeals. Under the chief judge's new order, we need to eliminate essentially the top two blocks in that last column. And so that's a huge undertaking for us to bring the delay down to what the chief has asked us to do.
Senator, one of the first.
Senator, oh, I'll go.
What percentage of, thank you, Mr. Chair, what percentage of cases would do you know are represented by the state-funded defense lawyers?
Chair Shields, Senator Burdett, most of the cases are represented by the indigent defense system. And because in the post-conviction system, the challenge often is to the adequacy of appellate counsel. They use their contract attorneys to handle the post-conviction cases. They use the attorneys who are in the centralized legal services division to do the direct appeals. So they have to split out those functions. But I would say over probably 95% of the defendants are represented by appointed counsel in these cases.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Is there any process to winnow out frivolous challenges?
Chair Shields, Senator Burdett, I think so. And my understanding of how their office works is that they do review the record. I think especially in the cases that are handled by the Centralized Legal Services Division, they do an excellent job of trying to have their attorneys trained and being efficient and looking for issues that are legitimate issues. We may disagree sometimes about how legitimate something is, but for the most part, I don't see serious problems in what they're doing. And that Balfour brief process is really the mechanism for saying there are no legitimate issues in the case. If the attorney decides that there are no legitimate issues, the defendant still has the option to present anything that he or she wants to the appellate court, as long as he can do it in 5 pages or less. And so they can raise issues, and that's frankly where we see the frivolous issues being presented in the courts, is that the attorney has said there's no issue in the case. The defendant still has the opportunity to raise whatever he wants. But that's simply part of how the system functions.
What I'm trying to get at here is I still don't have an answer as to why they've gone up so much. I mean, why there's been such an increase in the actual numbers. I mean, you're talking about over 10% of the prison population, the way I read these graphs. About 1,200 cases. I can't remember where that slide was.
The bottom of page 3.
Yeah, you've got 1,200 cases in direct appeals, and then another 400 in post-conviction appeals, and then the habeas, and so on top of that. I mean, that's over 10% of our prison population in court filing suit.
And Chair Shields, Senator Burdick, these cases are not only those individuals who are incarcerated in our prison population.
Yeah,
so
I think that would just be the post-conviction.
Well, actually, no. It includes cases that are violations. It includes cases that are misdemeanors where they may simply have a sentence of probation or and later in some of these they may be on post-prison supervision. They may be incarcerated in jails as opposed to in correctional facilities. But yes, we do have a large percentage of individuals who are convicted taking advantage of the opportunity to appeal those convictions.
Representative Cameron, then Senator Wesley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mary, just a quick question. I'm trying to get my hands around the unfunded hours. And do we have the attorneys on staff that if we had the funds we could move forward, or would it be overtime? I'm not quite clear, because do we just go out and hire more attorneys, and how does that work?
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, that last slide shows the number of new attorneys that we would actually hire, but what we did this biennium, we didn't lay off attorneys because we have other work that is in the appellate division. So many of the attorneys who would have been working on criminal cases and who would be available to work on these additional criminal cases if we had the funding, they shifted to doing non-criminal cases. They also shifted to doing some work that was not in the appellate division. So a number of them have been helping on the Measure 37 claims review and processing that's been handled primarily through the General Counsel Division. So, yes, about 4 of our FTE that we would need with this additional funding are attorneys who are existing attorneys, and it simply gives us the funding to allow them to do this criminal work. So we shift them back to doing the criminal work that they have done in the past. And then the rest would be new attorney positions added to the appellate division.
So by not assigning them to these cases, we had other work and other budgeted funds that we were able to shift their hours over?
Chair Shields, Representative Cameron, that's right. And because
and that
most
work
of
wouldn't
the
have got done had we had the funds to do this? I'm just curious about that.
It's been a mix of things. It's some work that we probably we've gotten to some work sooner than we would have otherwise. But like I said, we've also done some non-appellate work. And because of the increased need because of Measure 37, there was work in other parts of the department that these attorneys could spend time on. And so we also did some things in terms of maintaining some vacancies longer than we might have otherwise. And so not bringing on as many attorneys as quickly as we would when we had a vacant position.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Westland.
Thank you, Chair Shields. Mary, please don't misinterpret this question. I apologize for being gone yesterday. I was at a service of a very dear friend of all of ours. But does this additional funding request include the calculation of increased hourly staff hour rates for the staff attorneys?
Chair Shields, Senator Westland, yes. The funding model for 0709 is based on the proposed new rate for the attorney cost.
And while that doesn't address your numbers, actual cases issues, it does address some of the perhaps the cost increases. And let me just editorialize that the Department of Justice staff attorneys are some of the best bargains in the legal world. So,
thank you, Senator.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. one of the proposals before us is that we fund 139 state patrol folks or law enforcement. Do you have some sort of model or something that will eventually show what will be the effect of that down the line for you folks?
Chair Shields, Senator Nelson, the entire criminal justice system, changes in any one part really do have a ripple effect of changes elsewhere in the system. And so having more state police, having better trained investigators, having more resources to do better investigations up front, I believe means that we're going to have better cases and hopefully less error. And so it would reduce the cost eventually down the road, but it's very difficult to try to quantify that or to actually, you know, tie figures to that. One of the things that we spend time on that's not really tied to working these cases, for example, is training materials for prosecutors and being available to answer the phone for a district attorney who's in the middle of a trial and suddenly has a question of how do I handle something. And that time is well spent because it reduces the possibility that we're going to have error in these cases and we're going to have to reverse them and send them back for a new trial or not be able to have a new trial with them. And so there are these other impacts in the system that will have an effect on the work that we do. And you can look in a lot of places for where those effects are, and it's just really tough to pin down actual numbers of how those impacts work. I mean, I think changes that we look at in terms of the methamphetamine problem and treatment options for individuals and doing a better job there also have an effect in terms of the crime rate. And so you can look at that and say, well, if you could do a better job there, you could bring down the crimes, you could reduce the numbers of cases that ultimately we're going to see and the costs that ultimately we'd have. And so there's sort of an unlimited number of issues like that that you could identify when you look at that larger criminal justice system.
Just to follow up, it seemed like the district attorney's folks said that basically the same thing, is that potentially down the line you would reduce the cost if you did it the right way. How do we know that we're doing it the right way, or how do we know what sort of actions we should be taking, where we should be spending that money? So I'm still concerned about the rollout cost of this thing. Maybe it'll help in the future, but maybe it won't. So.
I will take that as a rhetorical question.
That's a rhetorical question, Mr. Brown.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I think Mary, what I'm struggling with is, as I look on page, it's now 11, from 0103 budget package actual of $1095 million. And that in less than 5 years, governor's requested is doubling. And I think what we're struggling with is why, and Ginny and I were arguing, Senator Burdick and I were arguing back and forth that, you know, more lawyers at OPDS doesn't increase the number of inmates appealing. And I think the issue is what's driving the inmates to appeal. And I don't know if it's lack of programming in the prison system. You said it probably wasn't measure 11, but I think that's what we're struggling with, is why we're seeing these huge number of increases this last, you know, 2 or 3 years. What's driving the inmates to appeal? So I think that's what we're struggling, at least that's what I'm struggling with.
If I can just add to that, what barriers can you think of that have been removed? I think that's another way to look at it, to appeals. Were there barriers before that have somehow been removed that could have been...
And Chair Shields, Senator Brown, and Senator Burdick, I wish I could give you answers to those questions because they're good questions, and I'm afraid I don't know what has changed. And it may be that it's a conversation we need to have with the Court of Appeals and with the public defenders and us jointly to try to take a look at these issues. There haven't been significant changes in terms of appellate procedures. I know that the Public Defender's Office has done a better job of making the process work more smoothly for initiating appeals. So they've used technology to allow these, and so that could have an impact. I don't have good answers to this. What we look at is really just what's coming in the door. And so what do we have to work on? And we've frankly been so busy kind of focusing on that piece that we haven't stepped back to say what else in the larger picture. We have identified a few little things that cases that we think are frankly really annoying and we wonder whether we should be spending our time on, like speeding tickets. But even those they're just small pieces of this, and they would only chip away at the very edges of this problem. We don't see any legislative change that would reduce how this workload is moving through the system.
Mr. Wilson would like to comment, then we'll go to Representative Nathanson, back to Senator Burdick.
Just keep in mind that the graph, members of the subcommittee, the graph on page 11, between 01, 03, and 05, 07, you also had rate increases that we were paying the attorneys. And so actually what you're doing is the real level of resources was falling during that period. There were actual cuts made to this budget. And so a lot of the increase in 07, 09 is due to that pent-up demand, for a lack of better term, to deal with the cases. So that's one of the things that's really driving this. And also the case mix has changed. And so there are more cases, like the capital cases moving into the federal courts, that are much more expensive. So it's also a case mix problem. So there's lots of factors going into this.
Before we go into, I'll add you, Senator Brown, I do want to comment on that. On page 4, it seemed, frankly, incredible to me, if you take a look at that bottom graph, the number of hours that are going into capital cases. I tallied those up, and I think, if my numbers are correct, 4,577 hours for an average capital case in the next biennium, which if you multiply by 128 is $585,000.
And
is that correct?
Chair Shields, these numbers reflect the hours spent on those. I'll tell you something about those cases, though, and how they differ from a non-capital case. In a non-capital case, you may see 2 to 3 claims of error on a direct appeal or a post-conviction appeal. In a capital case, that compares to you may see 40 claims of error in those cases. And so a lot more time has to be invested because we're responding to a lot more challenges, and the records are much larger in those cases. And so one of the things we've done to try to reduce the cost is actually to bring all of that capital work into the appellate division, including the trial work, because the records are so large that once we have a team that's gone through that, we don't want new attorneys having to go through that same record. But simply the scope of those cases, and partly because the direct appeals are automatic to the Oregon Supreme Court, that's another reason that the cases demand more resources, because what the Supreme Court says about those issues then will apply to all criminal cases throughout the state.
And so there are probably 2 or 3 cases that are fully at the federal habeas appeal level. Is that about right?
Chair Shields, we have 4 cases that have completed the post-conviction appeal process. And what those defendants have done, though, is to try to backtrack and start a new state post-conviction proceeding that's delayed the start of the federal habeas trial proceeding. And so those new ones are now moving forward to completion, and I expect will be completed fairly soon. So we're beginning to see and beginning to work on the first federal habeas trial cases. That's work that is a major piece of the growth in cost for next biennium.
And my last comment, and then we'll get to everybody else's questions. So then this problem is only going to increase, I presume, as these cases make their way to the federal. So in 2009 and beyond, we're going to be spending even more dollars on capital cases. Is that right?
Chair Shields, if you can take that last column for the chart at the top of page 4, I think what you would see is that's going to increase a bit into fiscal year 10, but because we're moving the cases so slowly out of the post-conviction trial system, and like I said, it's going to take us 20 years to get the cases really caught up. You're going to see that higher column continuing forward, but it's not going to continue to climb, so we're not going to add growth in each of those years for those cases, because we'll actually be moving some cases out of the final stages of review as new cases move in.
Okay, thank you. Representative Nicholson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have time for a couple of questions still?
Yeah, we should probably wrap up in 5 minutes so that we can get to the next section. Does that seem correct? or sooner? Is that what you're saying?
Okay. I'm going to talk fast, and if there's not time for responses to the committee today, perhaps tomorrow or in a written response. But I'll just throw my questions out as quickly as I can, all at once. The assumptions.
Nick, let me pause. If this is, I think, a very important topic because it's going to cost us so much money. So if it's okay with you all, maybe if we could push the child support to tomorrow also if we need to. Is that all right?
Thank you. Projections are based not only on a backlog and what you know is coming at you now, working off a backlog and what's coming at you now, but the assumptions are also based on the presumption that the climate of how we deal with the problem of improving public safety stays the same. If there were changes if there were some new approach for how we try to make our neighborhoods or our communities safer, that might have an impact ultimately on how much work you would have because it would impact what kinds of prosecutions we were seeing, for example. So given that, I do have a few questions. One is, you had mentioned that this isn't just people who have been incarcerated in a state prison. It might be violations of a number of kinds of things, and it may be people in county jails, not just state prison, or not even in jail. If there were if there were some sort of substantial difference in putting more emphasis on drug and treatment courts, would that likely impact your projections?
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, I would expect to see the effect of those kinds of changes not in the next biennium, but in subsequent ones, because the cases that we're going to be looking at next biennium have largely already been prosecuted, or they're in that piece of the system. And so the effect of any kinds of changes like that, I mean, you want to reduce these numbers. If you eliminated some things that are now crimes, that would certainly have an impact on what we would see down the road. It's not going to change significantly the cases that we're going to see in 07-09 because those cases are already on their way to us.
Mm-hmm. And then another question is, responding to your answer to a question a few minutes earlier, built into this is a new rate for attorneys. That would seem to exacerbate the difference that we've already heard about between prosecution and defense, and it's going to, it will make that difference even greater. So that's just something I need to think about. Well, what does that do to the information we've been receiving and requests we've been receiving for changing rates for public defense? And then the last point is, if is it possible to catch up at a slower rate? And there is a point, it seems like there is a point at which you have caught up, and so how would that impact the budget request? In other words, if we continue the base, if we increase all at once 100% of what's been requested, and we just continue that throughout the years, it seems that at some point in 4 or 6 years we will have already caught up, and it might have been possible to catch up slower but still meet that point at which you have a stable amount of resources to meet your needs. But it would just be a little further out rather than in 4 years. Did that make sense?
Yes, Chair Shields. Representative Nathanson, what we have tried to do in building this model is to focus only on the work that has to be done to avoid waiving appearance in cases. And so there's nothing in this model that, as our choice, reduces the backlog of cases or brings down delay. And in fact, as we built the model, it assumed that we could continue delaying these cases to a year for briefing. And we built the model to deal with only the work that was essential to be done, and anything less than what we're projecting, unless there's some changes in terms of our projections aren't correct or things changed in terms of the cases coming in, but assuming we're correct on that, building the model, that if we don't have the resources to do these cases, our only option at this point is to waive appearance and not have the state's interest represented in those cases. Thank you.
Senator Burdick and then Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have you kept data on the success of appeals over time? And can you give me kind of a sense of what's happened, where the defendant's appeal is successful and the state loses?
Chair Shields, Senator Burdick, since we've been tracking the performance measures, and we contribute to that first performance measure of the rate of success, the rate of success for the criminal appeals has always been around 92% to 93% in each of those categories. Actually, I guess we don't separate out the direct appeal, post-conviction, federal habeas appeals. But so we're at about 92%, 93% success rate. That does not include cases where we concede error. So sometimes we will get a brief, we'll review it, we'll say, yes, they're right. The sentence is greater than it should be, and we'll simply concede and ask the court to remand it to correct it. And so we don't count those cases in that win-loss rate. And that has held fairly steady. But I do know, because we review every case we lose, we always have a pretty good sense of, could we have done something different to avoid losing the case? And I guess that's where I'm seeing a bit of a change. It's not great if you look at the overall numbers, because our success rate is still at about 92%, 93%.
And that's commendable. I guess what I was trying to get at is we're spending an awful lot of money on appeals that are having an 8% success rate. And you did mention one case where the Balfour brief is filed and the defendant has a right to, you know, write up to 5 pages. How many? I'm just trying to figure out if there's some way to really, give justice to everyone, but to somehow winnow out the cases. I mean, you've got 95% of them covered by state paid attorneys, and I'm just trying to struggle because there are so many needs in our prison system. And if there's any way that justice can be served and still try to divert, now obviously the death penalty is an obvious example of huge amounts of money being spent on this small population of cases. You really have to ask yourself, and I'm sorry for the editorial comment, Mr. Chairman, but whether some of this money couldn't be better spent on the kinds of programs that are actually going to help people become productive members of the community. So I'm just frustrated that to see this money going down the drain, knowing the programs that are really needy and really are evidence-based and make a difference in improving public safety. Help.
If I can, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, you've got two little pieces of paper that have a great deal of influence on what they can and cannot do. One's the U.S. Constitution, the other's the Oregon Constitution. That's what's driving much of this. And I think I remember this from Biennia's past. Can't they get 16 bites at the apple, really? And there's some hugely large number.
Chair Shields, Senator Westland, where that comes in is if you actually take that at that very first slide and you add all of the levels, because after the possibility of state Supreme Court review, there's the possibility of U.S. Supreme Court review. And so, yes, there are a lot of opportunities to challenge these convictions. Many of them are controlled by federal law or the federal constitution, so we can't really do anything to change the federal habeas piece. or we looked last session at whether there was anything in the post-conviction process that could be changed or eliminated, and it becomes very complex quickly, because if you start to eliminate some of the pieces that are discretionary, what you may do is simply drive those issues into federal habeas and actually end up overall increasing the cost to the system, because the cost in federal habeas is so much greater. So it's a very complex system, and it's difficult to find places to simply cut or eliminate or kind of move cases other places, although other states take very different approaches to how they handle challenges to criminal convictions. And so there are a lot of different models for doing it that the state could look at and consider whether the cost might be different under some of those other models.
Senator Brown.
Actually, Representative Nathanson raised my issue about hourly rates for attorneys across the system, DOJ, DAs, public defenders. So very concerned about that.
Representative Barker.
These are awfully expensive, the capital cases. Of course, I don't know anybody who's saying somebody who's facing the death penalty shouldn't get every avenue possible. But it seems to me, somebody, and this is kind of anecdotally, but in watching a lot of cases and paying attention to some of these, somebody's facing a capital case, and then they'll, instead of going to trial, they'll opt out and take life without parole or life for 30 years before parole. And I mean, I would see that as a huge offsetting cost personally to that we're not trying people. People are not facing death penalty because they'll bargain that off the table. And so I don't know where the balance and I can certainly see what Senator Burdick's saying. But if it was my daughter that was splattered all over the place, I'd probably be vindictive and want to see the ultimate there. So, I agree, these are huge costs.
Well, and Chair Shields, Representative Barker, that's always an interesting discussion about the overall cost of having the death penalty or not, for the reason that you pointed out. I can think of three recent cases where someone facing the death penalty chose instead to go with a true life sentence. In one case, agreed not to pursue any appeals. And so I don't know how you measure the cost of the savings in those kinds of cases versus the cost of the death penalty cases that do proceed. We've tried to stay away from those policy choices and those other issues and simply looked at the state has the death penalty, this is what it costs.
And if I may, as a follow-up, I can recall, I've lived here all my life in Oregon, I can recall when the death penalty was taken off the table at one point, and the people who took it to the voters talked about the cost, and that time the voters said agreed with that it was too expensive. But then that was probably back around 1960, somewhere around there. I don't remember exactly, but and then of course the voters have put it back in. So
it was, I think, 1964 after Senator Hatfield oversaw an execution. But I think these are all topics that are perhaps might be best discussed in the policy committees. I want to make sure, though, on the essential budget package before we move on, if we look at page 11, and there is an $8 million cost there, and then flipping back over to page 4, where we see that cost of $585,000 per case, is it fair to say that maybe a third or half or 25% of that $8 million will be to go to work on death penalty cases?
We actually, Chair Shields, we do have the figures for the increase in cost for the capital cases versus the non-capital cases. And I believe, and we can provide the actual figures for you, but I think it is about 3 FTE that are going for the capital cases out of all of the FTE that are part of this package. And part of that is because we really are talking about moving these cases very slowly into the next phases of the system. And it will take some time to move them even from kind of through the federal habeas trial piece of that. So, but we can provide you with the figures for the specifics on the capital part of this model.
Yeah, that would be helpful. Any other questions? All right. What do you think? Should we...
I think we should start, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
On Charlesworth.
Ms. Williams, thank you very much for your testimony. It's very effective.
As the, Mr. Chair, as they're transitioning, please keep in mind another piece that is funded out of this defensive capital or defensive criminal conviction fund are the ballot measure costs that the AG incurs. There is no separate appropriation for ballot measure related costs, and this is the fundamental mechanism. It's not a gigantic amount, but it's not insignificant either.
Great. Thank you. Ready when you are, Mr. Kester.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is William Kester. I am the administrator for the Division of Child Support and also the director for the Oregon Child Support Program. I will briefly touch on some of the slides in your packet so that we can spend more time on the issues that are facing the division and the program. If I go too fast or if you would like to have more detail, please stop me. I'd be happy to provide it to you. The first slide is the mission statement for the Oregon Child Support Program, and our goal is to help parents meet their obligations to their children. The second slide shows the organizational chart for the division. The Division of Child Support is organized into two sections.
Speak up or move the microphone closer. Thank you.
Sorry.
Yeah.
The Division of Child Support is organized into two sections, the state operations and program development, the director, assistant director, section managers, and a district attorney liaison position make up the leadership team for the program. The program employs a total of 708 FTE. 561 positions are state employees in the Division of Child Support, and 147 are county employees in the 28 district attorney offices. The next slide just shows briefly the federal national strategic plan. It has four parts to it. Families come first, meaningful medical support for children, preventing the buildup of unpaid support, and accountability. The next slide will show you the Oregon Child Support Program strategic plan. This plan is the framework for the delivery of child support services to families. It is in line with the federal strategic plan. The vision, mission, and values reflect that children are our first priority. There are two components that make up the child support program. They are the Division of Child Support and the District Attorney Offices. There are 28 District Attorney Offices and 16 Division of Child Support Branch Offices. 8 district attorney offices have opted to contract with the Division of Child Support to provide services on their behalf. The Division of Child Support is responsible for child support cases where some type of public assistance, such as the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, or TANF, has or is currently being provided. The district attorney offices provide services to families where no assistance is being provided. There are several counties may be impacted by the recent loss of federal funds from the timber revenue. While we don't know the full impact to each individual county, by law, the Division of Child Support would be required to assume the caseload of that county if the county requests. We have had some informal inquiries, but no formal requests as yet. The next couple of slides will provide the services that the program currently provides. Step one in this process is that we receive a request for, a referral from another agency because a child is receiving assistance or they are in some type of state care, such as Oregon Youth Authority or Child Welfare. Or a family may apply directly for our services through one of our local child support offices. While any family can apply for our services, if a family is not receiving state assistance or their children are not in state care, they do not have to apply for our services. The next step is to locate the parents if needed. We have use of a wide variety of databases and the resources of both the state and federal parent locate service. The third step in the process is to determine if paternity needs to be established. Oregon has a voluntary acknowledgement program so fathers can acknowledge paternity without the need for a formal legal process. Paternity can also be established using the administrative process. DNA testing is available when requested, regardless of the process used to establish paternity. The fourth step in the services is that we will meet with the parents to evaluate their financial situation. We will review their current employment, assess the potential to earn if unemployed, health-related issues, looking at the special needs of the family for factors which should be taken into account when determining the amount of child support order. The parents' cooperation during this process is paramount to the establishment of a fair and equitable order. Oregon has guidelines to establish how much parents should pay for the support of their children and whether or not a parent will provide health insurance. All orders, whether done administratively or judicial, containing support or medical provisions are filed with the circuit court. The last step in the process is payments. All child support payments are sent to a centralized office in Salem. This office maintains all the payment records and provides the receipting and distribution for the total program. The next slide lists the enforcement tools that are available to us. Child support case managers will work with the parent to assess their situation and determine whether the parent is unwilling or unable to make child support payments. If the parent is unable to make payments, we may refer them to to community resources to help them meet their obligation. If a parent is able to pay but is unwilling, then the tools listed on the slide will be taken. The tools available to collect past due support and compel ongoing compliance are extensive due to prior legislative support. Two other sanctions may apply: license suspension. We can suspend the occupational, recreational, or driver's license for failure to pay support. This method is used to motivate the non-custodial parent to make regular payments. We can also do contempt of court, use contempt of court proceedings as well as criminal non-support when appropriate to sanction non-paying parents. The next slide is modifications. When an order is at least 2 years old, a party may request a review and adjustment of their order. Orders may also be reviewed if there's been a significant change in circumstances. The resulting order can be for more or less support than the original order, and the modification will take place of that order. Two additional areas is if a parent moves to another state, their child support obligation will continue. Oregon works cooperatively with other states to locate parents, establish and modify support, and do enforcement. The second area is that we work in close partnership with the tribes. Two tribes, the Klamath and the Confederate Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, have received startup funding from the federal government, and we will be working closely with them as they build their own child support program. The next slide shows the caseload for the program. We currently provide services to approximately 254,000 families. Reasons for the slight increase in our caseload I will explain later in the presentation. The next slide shows the collections, and they will continue to increase. The total collections for the 05-07 biennium should be approximately $626 million. A record 93% of collections were distributed to families during the federal fiscal year 06. The remaining 7% is divided between the state of Oregon and the federal government. Approximately 2.7% is kept by the state as recoveries from TANF, OYA, and child welfare cases. Recoveries for OYA and child welfare are not retained by the program, but are sent directly to those agencies. 4.2% goes to the federal government to offset their investment in the program. Child support collections will continue to increase during the 07-09 biennium. We are projecting $649 million for the 07-09 biennium if our current staffing levels are maintained. This chart also displays the potential reduction in collections if our staffing levels are not maintained. You will notice that the impact is greater in 09-11 if we are not able to maintain those levels. We estimate the heaviest impact will occur 12 to 18 months after positions are lost. The next slide shows the budget for the Division of Child Support, which is 36% of the department's budget. Funding for the Oregon Child Support Program comes from three primary sources: general funds, other funds, and federal funds. Other funds include recoveries from the TANF caseload as well as performance-based incentives paid by the federal government. Use of the incentive money is limited with the intent of reinvesting the money in the program. There are three budget drivers for the program. The first is the caseload. When someone receives public assistance, such as TANF, the case is automatically referred to us, and it remains our case until the child turns 18 or 21 if they are attending college. It will remain our case even after they no longer are receiving any type of assistance. This is where the most of the growth in our caseload occurs. The second driver is an audit of the Oregon Youth Authority. The Federal Office of Child Support Enforcement conducted a limited cost audit of the program in October of 2004. The main focus of the audit was the program claiming federal matching funds to work OIA cases. Preliminary findings were received by the program in November of 2006. The program responded to the audit and disputed a portion of their findings. The program received the final report at the end of last week, and we are currently in the process of detailed review and analysis. The final report concludes that cases referred to the program by the Oregon Youth Authority, which are closed custody, in other words, youths are incarcerated, are not eligible to receive matching federal funds, even if a given youth is eligible to receive state Medicaid. We will work closely with our legislative fiscal analysts for both the Department of Justice and the Oregon Youth Authority on the impact of this audit, and we'll be able to report to you more in the future. We do know that... I'm sorry.
Can I stop you real quick there? So just so that I understand this, in OIA's budget, then federal funds would be reimbursements to OIA that are child support payments?
Mr. Chairman, yes, when a child is placed in OIA's care, by law we are required to work that case, and so we will establish support obligation against the parent, and so any money that we collect, we turn over to OIA.
Okay, so that's going to affect their budget as well.
Correct.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Brown.
If I can just, while we're on that particular issue, is the audit new? And, I mean, I'm working on another budget issue with the juvenile PSRB, and it was pretty clear there that when youth under the jurisdiction of the PSRB are in closed custody, lock and secure facility, that federal dollars are not available. Is that a change for OIA funding?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, this relates to us working those cases because we have a statute that says we must. And so the audit was looking at our program and if we could claim federal matching funds to work those cases.
Okay.
And
got
so
it.
They are.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
And those, Mr. Chair, if I may just a follow up, both the caseload requirement, i.e., requiring you all to work TANF cases even when there's no TANF involved, and the OIA cases are statutorily driven, not federally driven?
Correct. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, correct. That's my understanding. It is a state law that requires us to work the Oregon Youth Authority cases.
Okay.
And, Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, to clarify a little bit, when the child is receiving public assistance and the case is referred to us, as we said, it remains our case till the child turns 18 or 21. Even after they close their grant. So if they're only on assistance for a year or 6 months, if we establish a child support order, we will continue to work that case until they're 18 or 21. One final comment on the Oregon Youth Authority audit. We do know that we will have to repay the federal government approximately $1.6 to $3.6 million. Some funds were already unscheduled for use earlier in this biennium. We anticipate we will be able to negotiate a payment plan for any remaining monies owed. The other impact will come in the form of a potential loss of revenue to the Oregon Youth Authority and the need for general fund resources to continue working these cases. Again, after analysis of the audit, we will be better able to provide information.
Mr. Kessler, I think we're getting close to the end. We've got a couple of minutes. I want to see if anybody had any questions to jump into, and if you wouldn't mind indulging us coming back tomorrow, we'd appreciate it.
Sure, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? Representative Cameron.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I heard you say that if a child is brought into the OIA under their authority, there's a chance that their parents would... have a judgment against them. Is that what I heard you say, that the
that you would collect while they're there to help offset their support?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, that is correct. We would, you know, just for example, if there's an order in place and the child is placed in OIA care, then they are basically, we would, any money we would collect, we would send to OIA.
Follow up for me. So the order would come from the court, basically?
No, we could also establish an order for to help offset the cost to the Oregon Youth Authority.
Thank you.
And just to fill in the picture on that, that would be similar to what would happen in a foster care case, correct?
And Mr. Chairman, child welfare works the same way.
Well, thank you very much. Senator Westland.
One quick question. Perhaps this is premature, but not unfair. Have you done any back-of-the-envelope guessing as to what it could possibly cost the department if some of the federal Timber Receipts counties throw the responsibility for child support back on the department?
We do have, Mr. Chairman, Senator Westland, are you talking that if a county did request that we take over their caseload, that how much that would cost the department?
Yes, sir.
We have done some preliminary work on that. I do not have that information available with me, but we can provide that.
Well, like I say, it's probably premature, but at some juncture, I think we're going to have to know.
Thank you. Mr. Kessler, we really appreciate you breaking up your testimony in 2 days. This meeting is adjourned. When we passed the Judicial Fitness and Disability budget last time, I needed to get carriers. And so it's a Senate bill, so I need a senator to carry it to the full Ways and Means Committee on Friday. Senator Nelson, are you willing to
He's
do that?
He's the most fit guy we have.
Good. And John Borden will get you the pony to prepare you for that. And then we're also going to need somebody to carry that on the House floor. Representative Cameron,
sure.
Would you be willing to carry that? Good. And John Borden can help you with your speech on the floor.
What was the bill number?
Yes, that would be for this Friday.
Was it Senate Bill what?
5519. All right. Again, this meeting is adjourned.